This is Pastor Williams. The tape you're about to hear is one of the most startling reports to be broadcast over the airwaves in this century. What you will hear is an interview with Fred Lucher, conducted by Tom Valentine, over Radio Free America's satellite radio program. This interview was broadcast on March 7, 1989. In this tape, I have edited out the commercials and extraneous material in order to get the whole interview on one C90 cassette tape. The subject is the alleged Nazi gas chambers in Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Majdanek, Poland, the locations at which some 6 million Jews were supposedly gassed and cremated by the Germans during World War II. As most of you know, the alleged genocide of the Jews by the Germans in World War II is accepted as fact by every major historian, newspaper, TV or radio station, every magazine or college or university in America. Even the courts in our land have officially recognized the so-called Holocaust as an unarguable fact. This is all based on the gas chamber killings claimed to have occurred at these camps in Poland. Now, what I'm saying is this. If the gas chamber killings really happened, then the Jews might have a case to prove their so-called Holocaust. But if the gas chambers never existed, then the whole Jewish Holocaust story falls apart. It simply didn't happen. Fred Lucher has scientifically, lawfully, and with unquestionable witnesses and testimony, dismantled this myth and proved it to be nothing but a huge hoax. I don't know what the Holocaust supporters are going to do with the Fred Lucher report. You listen for yourself. If you have ever had any thoughts that it was anything but a hoax, this tape will disabuse you of those thoughts.
Tonight, my guest is Fred Lucher. Spell his name is L-E-U-C-H-T-E-R. Fred Lucher, Loister, some people might say, is the author of The Lucher Report. The headline right there, The End of a Myth. This is an engineering report on the alleged execution gas chambers at Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Majdanek, Poland. And this report was a bombshell in the so-called revisionist controversy. We're going to deal with this as rational as possible, and this is in the area of hard evidence. This is not hearsay. This is hard evidence. Because Fred Lucher is the world's leading authority, or at least the United States' leading authority, on the building of gas chambers. So who better to go over and analyze the buildings that are on display at Auschwitz and Birkenau and Majdanek, and then put it all together in a report and say, this is what I learned, period. The man is a scientist, not a politician. He hasn't got any political or ethnic axe to bear at all. He's an interesting fellow. He made an outstanding report at the 9th annual meeting of the revisionists out in California a couple weekends ago, and he prepared this report under contract with Ernst Zundel of Canada for Ernst Zundel's second trial. And it was at the insistence of Dr. Robert Forrestone that somebody, somewhere, accumulate some hard forensic evidence so that we don't just have charge and countercharge when we're dealing with something as serious as the accusation that the Nazi Germans deliberately exterminated 4 million. Now, the term 6 million Jews includes all the Jews killed in World War II by the Nazi Germans, according to, if I may, the propaganda or the accepted line. The Auschwitz complex of gas chambers allegedly killed 4 million. So that's what the topic is tonight. We're going to discuss that in a very rational way, this remarkable report.
And on the other end of the line with me is Fred Lucher, who is the A 45-year-old engineer. Are you still 45?
That's in the report, Fred.
I'm 46 now.
46 now, okay. Now, you're an engineer out of Boston, Massachusetts, but your specialty is a unique one, and that is you are, according to Dr. Forrestone and his foreword here, you are one who specializes in the design and fabrication of execution hardware used in prison.
That is correct.
That's correct. You're the guy that fits up the gas chamber and the electric chair?
Yes.
And what are some of the other methods? The needle, the injection needle. You work with that also?
Yes, I do. We have a lethal injection system that we sell to the states utilizing lethal injection.
Oh, I see. So then you are, this is your area of expertise. Now, I wanted to get a little about you before we get to your report, which is an astounding report, and of course, you know it's extremely significant. Before 1987, you weren't much concerned about the history of World War II or anything like that, were you?
No, I wasn't.
You're just ordinary, you're a regular American guy that accepted pretty much what had come out of World War II.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. The gas chamber stories and everything.
Yes.
Okay. Now, Fred, you were asked by Ernst Zundel in Canada to analyze the famous gas chambers in Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Majdanek, Poland, on the basis of the fact that you're an engineer and he wanted to get an honest, thorough forensic report. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. Why don't you tell me exactly what it was that you did when you negotiated to do this for Ernst Zundel in Canada. I better tell everyone first. Ernst Zundel was on trial in Canada, and I believe it was his second trial after he had appealed the first time and was given a retrial. And Zundel was accused of publishing hate literature. They have a law against this. Anytime that anybody who had said that the Holocaust did not occur or that it was exaggerated was violating a Canadian law. And Zundel had been charged, tried, found guilty, then appealed, won on appeal, and was given a new trial. So we're in the second trial, and his attorney, Doug Christie, and Robert Forrestone, the advisor, probably the leading world authority on Holocaust revisionism, they wanted to find an expert that would be able to analyze the gas chambers that are still extant over in Poland. And over in Poland, these are still, they're used as kind of a museum today, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So tell us how this came about, Fred, that the negotiating to do this.
Okay. Well, unbeknownst to me, Zundel's defense team had made a determination that it would make a lot of sense for the trial to contract with an expert on execution equipment. They had searched for a number of years, and they ultimately wound up contacting the states here in the United States that utilized gas as a means of execution. They were referred primarily by Warden Bill Armantrout at the Missouri State Penitentiary to contact me, which they did. When I was first contacted, I wasn't aware at all, but I was being contacted by Dr. Farrison contacted me. He showed me
Fred, may I interrupt with you?
Right.
I think that the speaker phone is giving us a tremendous echo.
Okay.
And we're going to have to knock it off of there.
How's that, better?
Oh, much, much better.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but I just checked it on the monitor here, and you were getting this sound, you know how it went?
Yes.
So let's go back to the very beginning. The Zundel's team were trying to find an individual who was an expert in gas chamber technology.
That's correct.
And they contacted you through a fellow at the university, not the university, but the penitentiary in Missouri.
Yes, Warden Bill Armantrout. Warden Armantrout later testified at Zundel's trial as to the dangers involved in utilizing hydrogen cyanide for execution purposes.
Hmm.
But at any rate, after I spoke initially with Dr. Forrestone, I was asked to come to Canada, and I met with Ernst Zundel and his defense team. And we spent a very long and very busy weekend going over the photographs and the documentation that he had.
and he asked if I would be willing to go to Poland and undertake an investigation of the facilities there. I told him that I would. I also explained to him that up until now, I had no reason to question the Holocaust. I had some questions that now had been raised by the documentation that he presented to me. But I also told him that upon my return, if I found that these facilities could have been used as execution gas chambers, I would state so in my report.
All right, and he accepted that?
Yes, he did.
Okay. Now, did you have any idea what it was going to be like going to Poland beforehand?
No, I didn't.
It was quite a trip for you, wasn't it?
Yes, it was quite an experience for myself, my wife, and the rest of my team.
Now, what was your team made of? Let's talk about that.
Okay. In addition to myself, my wife came along, my wife Carolyn, as general assistant, and she recorded everything that happened. I also brought from the United States my draftsman, Howard Miller.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked with Howard for the last 10 years. He's a top-notch draftsman, and he aided me in making the measurements and documenting the sizes of the facilities that we looked at and also the locations from which we removed the forensic samples.
Now, when you say a forensic sample, can you give me a good example of what that would be?
Well, what we did is we removed pieces of brick and mortar from the facilities that the alleged gassings occurred. And we brought them back to the United States and supplied them to a test lab.
Mm-hmm.
We analyzed those samples to make a determination if this brick and mortar had ever been in the presence of hydrogen cyanide gas.
Right. Now, according to this, a fellow by the name of Dr. James Roth at Cornell University, who is the manager of Alpha Analytical Laboratories in Ashland, Massachusetts, analyzed these.
That is correct.
Okay, well, we'll get to that analysis later. Let's take this all one step at a time. Now, here you are, an American engineer, not really embroiled in this controversy any way, shape, or form. All of a sudden, you're up there, and you're meeting this fellow Forrestone and Zundel, and you didn't know anything about the controversy, did you?
No, I did not.
So when you heard their arguments and everything, what was your first reaction?
Well, I was a little surprised. One of the things that surprised me the most was that I thought that Canada had free speech. And unlike the United States, they do have this special law, and this law is apparently selectively used because, from what I understand, it's only been used once, and that was against Ernst Zundel.
Yes, that's the case, and that would have surprised me as an American, too, I think. We always look at Canada as being almost American.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now, when they showed you the photographs and the other materials about the gas chamber situation in Poland,
yeah.
Was there something about it that made you think that they might have a case?
Yes, because all of the photographs I saw, not only the photographs taken within and without the facilities, but also the aerial photographs taken by the U.S. Army Air Force during World War II, showed facilities that were not properly designed and could not have been used for gassings, because the facilities would have been such that they would have killed all of those people operating the facilities and other people in the immediate area.
In other words, this gas, this Zyklon B that we're told was used, is a hydrogen cyanide gas.
That is correct.
That's the same gas used in the gas chamber.
That's correct.
Now, that stuff is really dangerous, and so people that are working with it can get clobbered quickly, I take it.
Yes, it's extremely dangerous.
All right. Now, how long does it take for gas to kill someone in a closed room, let's say?
Well, in a gas chamber, in an American gas chamber, let's say in Missouri or Mississippi or one of the states that presently utilizes gas here in the United States, the individual is dead within 2 to 3 minutes. And he's unconscious within seconds after he takes his first breath.
Oh, in other words, it knocks you unconscious with the first breath.
That is correct.
So then your chances of escaping it are pretty slim then, because if it knocks you out.
Possible.
So if I'm pouring this stuff down into a room full of people, why, there's a good chance I could get knocked down.
That is correct.
How about a gas mask? Would that help me at all?
Gas masks, they have been used. They're not very effective. and they cannot be used for any longer than 10 minutes at a time because the cartridges break down. The only way this could be done would be to wear a complete chemical suit that's airtight and an air pack.
We didn't have anything like that back in World War II, did it?
No, we didn't.
Okay. All right, well, I don't want to get ahead of this investigation or anything, because it's extremely important, and I'm going to go through you step by step. But you put your team together. There were four people. Who was the fourth person now?
Well, there were two additional people that were part of the Canadian contingent. There was a gentleman who was actually from Germany. His name was Herr Rudolph.
Mm-hmm.
And he came along as our translator. And he spoke very fluent Polish, and he handled all of the problems. His first name was Theodore. And the last member of our contingent was Jürgen Neumann, who was a cinematographer from Canada. And he documented everything we did on videotape.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you're going over to Poland, and the Polish establishment, first of all, this is communist Poland now.
Yes.
And they're very much impressed by the Holocaust. They have a museum, don't they, advertise that this is where X number of Jews were killed by the Nazis and so on?
They do.
How many did they claim were killed in those facilities?
In excess of 6 million.
Well, that's the total number, but I thought they said only about 4 million has been gassed in that particular group of chambers.
Well, depending upon who you talk to, you will find that somebody will talk 4 and somebody else will talk 7 or 8.
Is that right? In over in Poland?
Yes.
Do they have tours, guided tours or anything like that?
Yes, they do. They have guided tours that are led by people that work for the museums themselves. And then there are also guided tours that are done by people from the United States and other European countries that bring people to show the alleged facilities.
I see. And these are the survivors that lead these tours and things like this?
Most of the people leading the tours are younger. I would say that they are probably students of the Holocaust.
Okay. In your report, on the purpose, it says the purpose of this report and the investigation upon which it is based is to determine whether the alleged execution gas chambers and crematory facilities at three sites in Poland, namely Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Majdanek, could have operated in the manner ascribed them in Holocaust literature. So that was your job, to go to see if this could be done the way we are told in the literature that it was done.
That is correct.
Okay, so you're going over to a communist country, and you're going to take along a hammer and a chisel, I imagine, and some other microscopes and things like this. I don't know what you took with you. I did hear your excellent report at the conference on revisionists, so I don't want to get ahead of everything. I'd like you to share with the audience that trip and what you went through.
I sure can. We arrived in Poland, and our first stop was at the main concentration camp at Auschwitz. We looked at the facilities the first day, which was the first day we could work, which was a Sunday, and we were running with a lot of difficulty because we were tripping over tours.
People everywhere, huh?
I beg your pardon?
People there everywhere.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, unfortunately, the first day we weren't able to get a lot accomplished beyond looking at the facilities and seeing how they were constructed. I had a hammer, chisel, and a star drill, and unfortunately I couldn't remove any forensic samples because all of the tour people were coming through, and I don't think anybody would have been too happy with my activities there.
No, you had to do this rather surreptitiously, I take it.
Yes.
Okay.
We left just after lunch the first day, and we went to Birkenau. And although there were tours at Birkenau, there were a lot fewer, and Birkenau is visited a lot less. It would seem that the Polish government tends to discourage people from looking at Birkenau. Most of the people, they wanted Auschwitz. Birkenau, which is sometimes called Auschwitz II, is a very large camp, and they don't allow motor vehicles inside the camp. And it took us almost 5 hours to make a transit of the areas that we had to see on the first day. And we removed our samples, and we photographed with both still photographs and also on videotape what we did at these facilities. The day was very cold. We walked through at least a half a dozen snow squalls that were so blinding we couldn't see the person in front of us or behind us.
Well, that gave you a lot of privacy then.
Yes. Off and on, we did have people walking through. There were a lot of Polish and Russian military personnel touring the camp.
Mm-hmm.
But fortunately, nobody saw us, and nobody saw me descend into the Krama 2 and remove the samples.
Okay, now, are these buildings pretty much the way they were, or alleged to be the way they were back in 1940, 42, and 3?
Yes. Auschwitz 1, which is the main camp, that is exactly, or presumably exactly, as it was at the time. We did find some minor changes, and our drawings that are shown in the report show that the show what changes had been made. At Birkenau, the two main facilities with the alleged gas chambers were the alleged gas chambers presumably existed, and the related crematories have been destroyed either by the German military at the end of the war or by the Russians or Poles after the war. Demolition teams blasted the supports for the buildings, and the buildings collapsed in on themselves. The areas under the buildings are accessible, and what I did in Krema 2 is I went down underneath all of this debris, crawled through 3 feet of water, and removed samples from both the walls, the ceiling, and also the floor that was at that point covered by water.
Now, you say Krema 2. Is that a crematorium?
Yes. The terminology that's normally used to describe these is Krema 1, which is at Auschwitz, the main camp. Krema, the other kremas are at Birkenau. And then there were other kremas that are not normally numbered at Lublin, which is where Majdanek is.
Uh-huh. Majdanek, that's the one I say. I incorrectly say Majdanek?
Yes.
Okay, Majdanek.
Well, pronouncing
okay.
It in English.
All right.
And I probably would have done that, except that I was told how it was pronounced.
Okay. All right. Now, you had blueprints or drawings of these buildings originally. Are those available?
They're not generally available. We had to bribe the officials at the museum in order to get copies of them.
But you were able to get copies of the original blueprints, then?
Yes, we were.
That's a very nice coup. Now you could see for yourself as an engineer exactly how those buildings were supposed to be put away, compare them with what there is today.
Yes.
All right, so that gave you a pretty good idea that you were dealing with reality anyway.
Yes, that's true.
Because, you know, there are stories, the revisionists tell stories, that in some of these camps, like one of them in Germany that was supposed to have the showers that the steam came out to kill all the people, had been rebuilt after the war by American servicemen or something to be an exhibit. And I don't know if that's true or not, but you wonder about all these things being rebuilt and saying, here it is, here's the way it was.
Yes.
But you knew then, you had a good idea that you were dealing with the real thing.
Yes.
Okay. Now, when you went into the Krema and you would be looking for forensic samples off the wall and things, what would you be looking for in those samples?
Well, we took our cue from what we saw at the delousing facilities. Now, at Birkenau and at Majdanek and also at Auschwitz I, they had areas where they deloused clothing. They deloused clothing through various means. Generally, it was either Zyklon B gas, which was allegedly used to kill the people,
mm-hmm.
or steam. Now, the facilities that they utilized for this were small chambers or rooms. They were no more than 4 feet wide by 6 feet long. And the rooms were properly sealed. They had proper paint, tar, and whatever was required to seal the facility so no gas leaked out. And they had stacks and fans for evacuating the poison gas after they utilized the delousing chambers.
So these delousing chambers were indeed something that were gas chamber rooms, and very small ones for the for the getting rid of the lice in all the uniforms.
Yes, and what normally happened is these people that were brought to the concentration camps were brought into one area where they took their clothes off, they had their head shaved to eliminate all of the lice and such that was in their hair. Their clothing would then be put through the delousing chamber. They would go through the shower room and pick up their clothes on the clean side. So it was set up on a very orderly and methodical basis.
Actually, they were saving a lot of lives, too.
Yes, they were.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so these are these little rooms that were used as delousing facilities. Now, you took forensic samples off of them.
Yes, we did. And we took our control sample from delousing facility number one in Birkenau. Now, one of the important things to note about this and what the supporters of the Holocaust have been saying for many years is that these chambers are covered, the walls are covered with a blue chemical, which is true. And this chemical is referred to as Prussian blue. It's a dye that they used to dye the old Prussian military uniforms with.
Mm-hmm.
And it was made with hydrogen cyanide. And the key here, and the reason that this Prussian blue was retained on the wall for over 50 years, is that the water in Poland has been and still is now extremely high in iron content.
Mm-hmm.
The brick and mortar is loaded with iron. When the iron comes in contact with the hydrogen cyanide gas, it immediately forms a compound that's very difficult to destroy and will last for years, ferric ferrocyanide,
which is
this blue pigment.
Okay, ferric ferrocyanide. Okay, that's the telltale stuff that would be everywhere there was a gas chamber.
That is correct.
Okay, now that's just the delousing chambers. These are 4x6 rooms. It would be absolutely ridiculous to assume that these were the rooms that 6 million bodies went through.
Yes.
So then you now go into the large rooms that are to be gas chambers.
That's correct.
And you'd already looked at them and everything else. Even before you started taking your samples, were you struck by anything when you saw that?
Yes, the first thing that's noticeable is that these alleged gas chambers are too small to have held the number of people that they presumably held. The second thing that's noticeable is that none of these rooms are sealed. All of the delousing facilities are sealed with pitch and tar. The standard procedure for fumigating a building or delousing, or when you're building a delousing facility, is to coat it with tar and seal all of the openings so no gas leaks out. Today, when we do this with the gas chambers, they paint them with epoxy paint. But in the 30s and 40s, they didn't have epoxy paint, so what they utilized was pitch and tar.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that's noticeable is none of these facilities had exhaust fans or exhaust stacks. A stack from a gas chamber should go 30 to 40 feet in the air so that the gas is exhausted and blown away and dissipated by the atmosphere, and it doesn't drop and hover and kill anyone in the immediate area.
All right. When the photographs were taken during World War II by the aerial photographs, by the bombers and so forth, the Allied forces, were there any smokestacks on these buildings or exhaust stacks on these buildings?
There is certainly none evident in the photographs.
Okay. Now, that tells me all I need to know. There were none evident. So there's none there now, and there were none evident. And yet these guides, the guides over in Poland, are going through and saying, this room here is where they stacked in X number of hundreds of Jews and then turned the gas on and killed them and then dragged them out and burned them. They describe all of these things that allegedly happened. And the world believes this fervently, I might add, and emotionally. Okay. Well, now we're over there, we're examining this thing, and you had gone into a crematorium, or a crema, you said. Now, I asked you, was that a crematorium? That's where they burn the bodies.
Yes.
Now, what kind of forensic evidence would you want to get off the walls there?
Well, we didn't remove forensic evidence from the walls of the crematories, but what we did do is we counted the number of furnaces, we looked at the size of the furnaces, and made a determination of what type of equipment that they were using. The equipment that they were using is in conformance with both the Holocaust supporters and the revisionists allege they used.
All right. In other words, they really had a crematorium that used X number of degrees of heat for so long and this sort of thing.
That is correct, but the problem is that that the numbers of people that were allegedly cremated in these facilities, it would have taken 70 years to cremate that number of people.
Is that around the clock?
That's around the clock with no downtime, and assuming that they don't have to do any maintenance or nothing is going to burn out.
In other words, if these furnaces don't break down ever, and there's plenty of fuel, you got to remember we got to have plenty of fuel for them, and they run around the clock, they take them 70 years to burn the bodies that were alleged to come out of there.
Yes. It would have also taken in excess of 40 years to execute this. Allegedly executed at some of the other facilities, which presumably were only transit camps. And the procedure that was utilized at these other facilities was presumably carbon monoxide. And I would like to indicate at this point that it is not possible to do any type of large-scale execution with carbon monoxide because of the quantity of the parts per million requirement in order to cause or affect death. Carbon monoxide is extremely slow, and although it's possible for somebody in his garage to kill himself by running his car, if you take a room and fill it with people, in order to get the amount of carbon monoxide mixed with the air, you would have to pressurize the room to at least 2.5 atmospheres. And an atmosphere is 15.7 pounds per square inch.
Okay, now wait a minute. We have heard these stories that they would push people in the room, 100 of them into a room that would only hold 10, and then they locked the doors, and then they had an exhaust pipe hooked to it, and then they would start the engine, and the engine exhaust would be used to kill all the people in the room. That's the story that's been passed around for 45, 50 years.
Yes.
And you say that that's not possible?
It's not only not possible, but it never happened.
Okay, it never happened. All right, that's a better way of putting it. How about those? We're going to skip the subject for a second, but we also have read, those of us who have read the stories of World War II and the Holocaust and so on, that they had gas vans, that they actually had vehicles that were ran on carbon monoxide. You recall the gas vans that were made in the 1930s? Ford Motor Company made some of them in Germany, and they actually would burn just about anything they could burn, and they would drive the cars with the carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide expansion. Are you familiar with those?
Yes, I've read about them.
And even that kind of a carbon monoxide machine wouldn't do the job because you have to pressurize it.
Yes, I would say that you probably might be able to kill 4 or 5 people with the atmosphere not being pressurized.
So in order to do it with exhaust of any kind, they had to have a pressurized room, which means you really have to have it sealed and a method for bringing that pressure, squeezing it down.
Yes.
Well, how do you go about making a room that size pressurized? What would you have to do?
Well, it would have to be made out of something other than brick or stone. It would probably have to be made out of steel. It would have to be sealed, much in the same way that we make gas chambers here in the United States. A proper gas chamber operates at a negative pressure, so it leaks inward. You'd have to make something that was spherical in structure, and much like a compressor tank on an air compressor.
So we have a myth that is totally exploded by the facts, the engineering facts of the situation. And if you use a diesel engine, as some of them have written in the Holocaust literature, that would even be tougher.
Yes, because there's less carbon monoxide in the diesel exhaust, although it smells worse, than there is in the general automobile exhaust.
Good Lord. Okay, so now we're coming up. You have these buildings that have allegedly been used. It would have taken 40 years going around the clock, if they could have done it at all, to execute that many people in these buildings. Now, I am going to ask you after the next break about the taking the forensic samples off of these buildings, which you did.
Yes, correct.
Now, even before we get to the break, did you have any of that blue ferric oxide stuff?
Ferroferric cyanide.
Yeah, ferroferric cyanide.
Yes.
Was there any in these buildings?
There was none visible in any of the alleged gas chambers.
And these four and a half buildings that were said to be the ones in which the millions of people were gassed, none of this telltale quality material that you're going to have to name for me again.
That is correct.
Ferroferric cyanide.
Yes.
And it was found in the delousing room, because that was where they indeed used the gas, Zyklon B, to kill the lice.
That is correct.
But it's not in the buildings where the people were allegedly killed.
No.
Huh? So we have no smoking gun, so to speak. We're talking with Fred Lucher, and the subject is the crematory and the gas chambers at Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Majdanek in Poland. The area alleged to have taken the lives of 6 million Jews in World War II. Actually, the actual killing, extermination, was to have taken place between which years? When did it start and when did it end? Didn't it start in 1941, according to the stories?
Yes, 1941 through 1945, and it was supposedly intermittent and took place over 3 and 4 month intervals.
I see. So it really wasn't 5 years around the clock.
No.
And you've already computed that if they were to have done the job on what figure did you use, 6 million?
Yes.
To do 6 million would take 40 years to kill them all, and then 70 years to cremate them. And they'd have had a pile of bones they didn't know what to do with.
Yeah, well, 68 years is my exact number to execute all these people, and it would have taken something over 40. I'm looking at my notes here,
mm-hmm.
and that would be, they would have had to have gassed 1,693 persons a week.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things to consider here is that the gas that was being utilized was in pellets, and when they allegedly dropped these pellets into the room, the pellets had to have been heated, and of course there was no facilities for heating these pellets to drive the gas out of them. What they did is they absorbed gas into particles of wood and chalk. The other consideration here is that in order to circulate the gas properly, you must have at least 3 square feet for each person.
Oh, if you cram the room full of people, as we're told they did,
yes,
then you can't circulate the gas. It won't do its job.
No, and probably what that would mean is that if you did put all these people in a room and you did manage to somehow put gas in, and you couldn't use the gas as they allegedly had it in the Zyklon B pellets, what you'd have to do is have liquid gas and then boil it off and then pump it into the room. It would probably take five or six days to get the gas to go throughout the room enough in order to kill all these people.
Okay, let's say they were successful in getting the room filled with gas. Now they've got 300 bodies in there. This is a horrible topic, but it's one that we have been living with, and the Germans have been considered guilty of for 40 years. Here we've got this, let's say, a mass of bodies. We'll use 300 as a figure.
Yeah.
Now they found a way somehow to do what you say is literally engineering-wise impossible. But they've got all this gas in the room. Now they've got, according to stories, why the guys went in with cigarettes in their mouths and hauled the bodies out before they shoved in the next batch.
Yeah.
What kind of a probability is there for that?
Well, that's totally ludicrous, because when someone dies of hydrogen cyanide poisoning, the cyanide is exuded from their pores and remains on their skin. When a gas chamber is utilized in the United States, the gas chamber, after it's evacuated, and it must be evacuated with hot air that's warmer than 79 degrees, or else the gas will condense on the walls of the chamber. But assuming after you got all this gas out, you had the proper temperature, you have to wash the chamber down with either ammonia or chlorine bleach. And this also includes the subject. The subject cannot be wearing clothes. When we execute people here in the United States, they wear gym shorts, because their clothes also becomes permeated with the sweat that exudes from their body, and their underwear would be coated, or their shirt, pants, whatever they were wearing, would be thoroughly saturated with hydrogen cyanide. in a form that would be liquid at that point, which would be, which we would call prussic acid. So the entire chamber must be washed with either ammonia or chlorine bleach. The dead subject must be washed with chlorine bleach or ammonia. And anyone who touches these people would probably be dead within 45 minutes to an hour.
Just touching them. Actually, just let's say somebody at the Missouri gas chamber has just been gassed.
Yes.
And he's wearing overalls instead of a gym suit.
Yeah.
And we force the gas out of the chamber. Then I reach in and bring the body out. I am going to grab a hold of his clothes and his body, and I'm going to get some residue on me, and that will kill me.
Yes. Probably within 15 minutes you would be sick, and probably within 45 minutes to an hour, unless you receive some emergency medical treatment, you would have respiratory failure.
Well, if this is so known among people like yourself who deal with the subject, how is it that this gas chamber story could have been circulated as absolute fact for all these years? I don't expect you to answer that, but I mean, that's not your thing, but it seems awfully ludicrous, doesn't it?
I think very few people realize the mechanics of gassing and understand them.
Because now you see the stories we all, as a boy, I remember being told that the workers would then go in and bring all the bodies out, throw them into a pit or something, and bring in some more bodies. Why, it seems to me all you needed to do was get the room good and saturated and to run them through. They'd get the residue on, and an hour later they'd be dead.
That is correct.
Maybe they could have done it that way.
I wouldn't really think that would be a good procedure to do it, because it's not an effective means of executing people. I mean, it would be a lot simpler if we wanted to execute this number of people simply to shoot them.
Yes. Was there an attempt to really gas some people? You think there were some experiments that went on that they were trying to gas some people? Maybe they had some criminals they wanted to gas. You pointed out in your report, by the way, excellent report, in the back you have all of these drawings, and
yes.
These were done by your draftsman that you took with you, and
yes.
You show each unit and everything. Back on the very back, you have an unknown heater circulator experimental gas chamber in Majdanek.
That is correct.
Now, what was that all about?
Well, I don't, to be quite frank, I don't know what the purpose of the heater was. I do know that there was a small electric blower motor, and there were two ducts. The ducts were spaced too close together to effectively circulate the air in the room. To be quite frank, I don't believe that the heater circulator that was there could have effectively heated or circulated the air in the room. I don't know what it was put there for, and I don't even know if it was put there by the Germans. It certainly wasn't put there by an engineer or a technician. The technique of gassing was known well before the alleged gassings in Poland. It doesn't make sense to me that the Germans would attempt to reinvent the wheel, or that they would even go off in a direction that couldn't possibly work. They would have simply had to have looked at the United States, saw how we built our gas chambers, and then built large ones to operate in the same fashion.
If they had truly had an extermination program, they could have done it. When did the first gas chambers come into being?
Approximately 1920.
1920, that's right. We hear about these big criminals back then getting the gas chambers, sure.
Yes.
And they drop a pellet into some liquid. And I believe they had, the way I used to see it described in California, a pellet went into
that. That is correct. They dropped sodium cyanide, either briquette, granules, or in the early days they called them eggs. Into a dilute solution of 18% sulfuric acid. The sulfuric acid went into a reaction with the sodium cyanide. The reaction is what we call autocatalytic. It generates a tremendous amount of heat, and it's not able to be stopped once it stops.
Oh, it's sort of like thermite.
That's correct. So all of the gas is given off, and what left with the remaining gas is mixed in the sulfuric acid that's sitting in the crock pot. And this is very deadly poison. It's prussic acid, and it's very difficult for those people who work at the prisons to dispose of because they have to handle it.
So then if the Germans really were gassing millions of people, they would have had a tremendous logistic problem just in handling the toxic material.
That is correct. Now, one of the other things that has to be considered is the gas is highly flammable and explosive.
Yeah, that's the part about the cigarette smoke that got some people way back that I recall.
Yeah, well, not only the cigarette smoke, but these alleged gas chambers were operated in close proximity to the crematory. In some cases, there were no doors separating the alleged gas chamber room from the alleged crematory. In other places, there were only a wooden door that would have leaked like the devil. And we find that the crematories, standard European crematories, operated at about 1,400 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, in the United States, we operate somewhat higher, 18 to 19. These German crematories could not have sustained the 1,400 degree temperature for any long period of time because of the way they were designed and built. They were just old brick. They didn't have the modern ceramics that we have today to operate these facilities. So what we now would have had is we would have had the gas leaking into the crematory, and probably 10 minutes after the alleged gassing commenced, the building would have been leveled by a tremendous explosion.
This cyanide gas is really explosive. I mean, it's not just like a little bit of gasoline or something.
That's correct. Now, none of the lighting in the alleged facilities is explosion-proof now. It probably wasn't explosion-proof then. And one of the things that concerned me is I've had several people say, well, the lighting could have been changed, and nobody thought to put back explosion-proof lighting. This may be. The wiring and the fixtures in the facilities look to be original. But the consideration here is that the way the gassings took place, or allegedly took place, is that these pellets were thrown on the floor. And in the vicinity of the chalk pellet or the pulp paper pellet that was giving off the gas, there would be a 90 to 100% concentration of gas, which is extremely explosive. Anyone with a nail sticking out of his shoe that scuffed on the floor would have caused a spark and would have detonated the entire gas chamber, not even having to have it leak into the crematory.
All right. Now, they didn't know what you were doing when you were over there, they being the authorities that run this Holocaust Museum. Did you tell them I'm coming over here to take samples and verify this? Or?
No, we didn't, because I didn't feel that they would have been too friendly toward us. There is another gentleman who's a well-known revisionist that broke into one of the buildings, the sauna building at Birkenau, and because of that spent 3 days in solitary and was expelled from the country and can no longer enter Poland.
Oh, that's a Dietlitz Felderer.
Yes.
Yes.
Dietlitz
Felderer. Yes.
We arrived, and we not only had to break into the same building, but we had to break into the delousing facility as well.
Now, you realized you were taking a pretty big chance, didn't you?
Yes, I did. We kept our eyes open. My wife was at one end of the building normally, and our interpreter was at the other end. And if anybody approached, they would holler, and we would quickly button up. When we broke into these facilities, we did it when nobody was around, and we worked as fast as we could, and we left.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had to go up to the walls and chip away and put this the mortar or whatever it was you were chipping away into little baggies, huh? And,
that is correct.
And then mark it, exhibit number so-and-so out of building so-and-so.
Yes, we had to wear dust masks and also rubber surgical gloves, because we didn't want to be ingesting or allowing any of the hydrogen cyanide material into our skin.
It turned out really didn't have that much of a worry except in the delousing chambers.
That is correct.
Uh-huh. But you didn't know that.
We expected that, but nevertheless, if anybody views the videotape, they can see we approached all of the samples with the same caution.
Uh-huh. Now, your report belongs to Mr. Zundel.
That is correct.
Who paid for it. And the videotape, is that also his?
Yes, it is.
All right. Now, I don't happen to know, does the Institute of Historical Review are making those available?
I believe they...
I know the report
they are
is.
Selling some. The reports, both the abridged version, which is the small one, and the full report, which contains all of the lab reports and such, are available and distributed by David Clark.
Yes.
Decatur, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
I believe you have it. At
yes, I do. It's if they want it, it's Post Office Box 726, Decatur, Alabama, 35602. And that's David Clark, just like it sounds. David, C-L-A-R-K, Clark. Post Office
correct.
Box, P.O. Box 726, Decatur, Alabama, 35602. And he has the complete report. One I have here is a quick, simple, but it's pretty doggone complete, too. Report on the subject. Now, this has to have been a profound experience here. You're a 46-year-old man. You're at the pinnacle of your particular profession. I mean, you're the best in the business of what you do. And all of a sudden, you are thrust into probably the most controversial topic in the United States today.
Now, that's probably very true.
What kind of effect? What's going on in your mind? How do you feel about all this?
Well, I think the thing that bothered me the most, and the thing that I'm most upset about, is the fact that I have been lied to for the first 40 years of my life. I, like you did and most Americans, went through grammar school, high school, and then college, and we were taught about the Holocaust, we were taught about the German gas chambers, and then to suddenly find out that they didn't exist. They couldn't have existed. And the thing that's upsetting is that no one has made any attempt to investigate these. I recently spoke at the Institute of Historical Review in California and at their 9th annual meeting.
Yes.
And I asked at that time, and I would ask that any of the listeners here tonight, I would ask that they support that an independent team of international scientists and historians be put together to go to Poland and do the same forensic analysis that I did, the same historical analysis, and the same engineering analysis. Because it's about time that everybody knows that this didn't happen.
Okay, now, would it be possible for the establishment to put together a team to go over and come back with some kind of claims that you're wrong? Could they salt those walls with hydrogen cyanide between now and then?
It's probably possible. The difficulty would be that we took so many photographs and videotapes that that it would immediately show up on an examination. I mean, we couldn't possibly doctor the tape. We couldn't possibly doctor the negatives from the photographs that we took. I'm shown in these things chipping samples off the wall. What would have to be done is that somebody would have to go with my report and go to the same locations that I removed these samples and take a sample right next to them. And then additionally take samples from wherever they might want.
Well, anyway, you're very confident in the results that you have seen based upon your expertise. There's just no doubt in your mind now that this whole thing has been a gross exaggeration for political purposes or for whatever purpose.
Not at all. I wouldn't speculate as to the purpose. The only thing I can say is that I'm very unhappy that what has transpired over the last 50 years and what everybody has been taught is not true.
I guess that one would be very unhappy. And I'm wondering now, has anyone outside of those people, such as myself, who are familiar with the revisionists, I've been watching them for several years now myself, and learning and becoming impressed with what they're saying each year, more and more impressed, has anyone in the media outside of that decided to talk to you about this, or have been curious enough to go over it with you?
No, they haven't. Since I wrote the report, and the report has been available to the world at large for 9 or 10 months now. I haven't heard from anyone, and nobody has called to question me on it.
You mean the Boston Globe isn't curious that one of its citizens has done this service?
Apparently not.
I just don't think that's good news. If I were the city editor of that paper, why, I'd have a reporter and photographer over in a minute. Well, we can understand. Those of us who've been watching the political side of all this can understand. We're talking with Fred Lucher, the engineer who went to Poland and took a good close look at the alleged gas chambers that were used during the years 1941 to 1945 to exterminate 6 million Jews. And he has come back with a report that refutes this legend that all of us grew up believing, and many still walking the streets today absolutely believe. Now, Fred, you were in Canada, and you were on a witness in the trial of Ernst Zundel.
Yes, I was.
Let's see. Doug Christie is the attorney. They brought you on there. Now, did the prosecution already have advance notice of your report?
Yes, they did.
Were you cross-examined?
Yes, I was. The unfortunate part of it is that the court did not properly handle the district attorney and the manner in which he did the questioning. The report itself was not admitted into evidence, but all of the material in the report was gotten into the evidence by virtue of the fact that I had to testify.
Yes.
The unfortunate part of it is the district attorney was given a copy of my report several days before before I was to testify. He examined the report. He made a list of questions. And then he asked the judge not to allow the report. Well, the judge denied the report going in as an exhibit, but again did allow me to testify. But the problem is that he allowed the district attorney to question me from the report, which was totally unfair from Mr. Zundel's standpoint, because what was happening here is that he wasn't allowed to get the full weight of the report in terms of the document, but he allowed the opposition to question him from that same platform. The district attorney spent most of his time initially trying to damage my credibility and destroy my credentials. And there's a somewhat different situation in Canada as in Europe, where engineers are not college graduates, as they are in the United States, but they're technical school graduates. And they questioned my credentials based on the fact that I didn't graduate from a technical school, but I was a graduate of a college, Boston University, here in the United States.
Boston U. Well, that's incredible. That's a credible school.
Yes. At any rate, the judge finally decided that based on the fact that I was an engineer, I was recognized by the United States Navy and a good number of the government agencies here in the United States, and by virtue of the fact that I've been working for the last 10 years on execution hardware and gas chambers, that there was no way they could exclude the testimony. I was allowed to testify. The unfortunate part of it is a lot of the historical information that was brought in by the district attorney came from Professor Hilberg's books.
Raoul Hilberg, yes.
And Raoul Hilberg, of course, is a professor, I believe, from Vermont, from a school in Vermont. And Raoul Hilberg has attempted to define these things in some degree of technical or engineering terms, in terms of claiming that there were exhaust fans and all kinds of hardware that never existed.
And you were able, during your testimony, to get into this then?
Yes. The locations and the descriptions that Raoul Hilberg describes totally aren't there. He has blueprints that must have been drawn by someone other than the authorities at Birkenau, or the Polish authorities, or the German authorities. He shows a building with concrete cast ducts for evacuating gas that are not there.
Well, he must have been an engineer, but he needed these things in order to make the story seem plausible.
Yes. And apparently what has happened, it appears as though these drawings and these descriptions supplied by Mr. Hilberg are totally spurious. They have no relationship to the facility, now or then.
Now, Doug Christie is an extremely good lawyer, from what I understand.
Yes.
Did he lead you in the questioning so that you were able to get all of these zingers in?
Yes, he did. And one of the fortunate things, and it was very interesting as far as the Canadian courtroom procedure, is that once you're qualified as an expert, you're allowed to argue with the district attorney.
Oh, that's nice.
And I've testified a number of times here in the United States, and when the district attorney complains to the judge then will either tell you just to answer the question or say, well, I'll allow what he said.
The gassings and so on took place and then took them back. He's an engineer in his own right. He has his own laboratory, but sent them to another laboratory, and they could find no evidence that there was any... what was a prussic acid or whatever acid, whatever they were looking for, they could find no evidence in any of the scrapings that this took place.
Uh-huh.
Except in one unit where there was a very, very small amount.
It was a delousing chamber,
yeah,
though. It was only
said,
four by 6 feet.
Yeah, which they said was consistent with what would be needed for delousing.
Uh-huh.
But now, where does that station emanate from?
It's coming from Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
But it's advertised in the spotlight.
Uh-huh.
That's Washington's weekly paper.
Now, you recognize, of course, that the United States has far greater freedom of speech than Canada.